Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com.
We got our good friend. Speaking of lumber, we got our good friend Woody now. And right? Is he on the line? Shortly. And anyway, I want him to... You just had a hilarious exchange in the inbox that I want to read out loud. Is that okay?
Go for it.
I don't usually read.
Breaking inbox privileges here, but that's all right. I'll allow it. I'll give you permission.
Aiden from Abbotsford texted in about Rick Tocchet. Tocchet going on TNT is terrible for me because the worst Twitter accounts are clipping his segments and being so loud and wrong. Loud and wrong, baby. That's the way to be.
That's Twitter.
No, that's Twitter. That's our show. I hope to God he's coaching next year and not on TV, says Aiden. To which you replied, that's a great point. I do not need half of Canucks Twitter freaking out every time Tocchet says he likes structure on TNT. Now, there was a clip in particular of Tocchet breaking down faceoff plays, which is what he did for Canada, by the way, when they won that historic Four Nations faceoff final against...
Off a faceoff. Yeah.
Because they hit the nipple.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah.
You were so mad at me about that.
The nipple.
The nipple. McDavid was the nipple on that play.
Classic McDavid.
Anyway, jeez, I need to focus up. So on that play, Tocchet diagrams the idea of not shooting from a poor angle, but instead recycling the puck up top so that you can set up either a point shot from a central portion of the ice with traffic in front or a one-timer. With really the idea being that only pass it in front if you've got a guy streaking down toward the net to provide some net front coverage. Now, we've got Woodley on the line now.
Yes.
And Kevin Woodley knows a little bit about shot quality and the differences or the difficulty that goalies face depending on situation. Did you see the Tocchet breakdown that got memed into oblivion on TNT over the weekend, Woody?
I did not. I apologize.
Oh,
I
haven't. No.
I mean, I watched through all the goals, but I didn't see a lot of, I didn't get to watch a lot live. So
this is because you have a better work-life balance than Drance.
With all due respect to the TNT guys, I'm not sitting through the intermissions when I'm playing catch-up.
And apparently you're not following the people I am on Twitter because it was a constant topic of discussion. So I'm going to describe the play from you so that we can discuss it because I still want your insight on this, Kevin, and I'm not going away that easy. So effectively, Tocchet is describing a face-off set play where you've got a guy sort of in the high slot but not at the net, and the forward gets the puck relatively low in the zone, like let's say 3 feet to the right of the face-off dot on the right side of the offensive zone and maybe 2 feet up the wall, so on the half wall. And his point was, don't just fling it at the net in that situation. You want to see a delay play. You want to see it work back to the point. And you want to see a D-to-D pass, get it to a central position of the ice to set up either a one-timer option on the left flank or a shot through layered traffic from the middle of the high slot from the point. And Canucks fans were like, Tocchet preferring that you manage risk and passing up on shots. This is everything that's wrong with a conservative-minded coach. And I had the reaction, the Hannibal Buress reaction of like, why are you booing? He's right. What are your thoughts on sort of that situation?
I think two things. If the options are to get it up top with a layered screen, you know I love me some layered screens, Thomas. So you are like just, you know... You're playing. I feel like I'm being set up here.
You are.
But it also, like, the other thing depends is, you know, when that initial guy gets it off the half wall, like, is there net drive? Like, you can create from dead angles. You can create off sharp angle shots. But the key part of it all is, are you just throwing a puck at net with bodies or are you just throwing a puck at net? Because, you know, I've said this all along, like for years we had these teams that got pucks to net with nothing else going there, at least not with any purpose. And all you're doing is making the other goalie feel good and padding his save percentage. Cause that initial shot you described without any layers, without any traffic, without any net drive is essentially a controlled save. And whether that is catch the puck and eat it, you know, steer it into the stands, either with a blocker or with a stick, Like, that's an easily controlled save for most goaltenders. That said, I mean, look at how much garbage we're seeing off sticks, off legs, funneled from, you know, sort of that area you initially described. And so to me, it's all what else is going on in that moment. Dead angle plays, yeah, sharp angle plays, and that isn't quite a dead angle. That's higher up in the zone than that. Your risk, if you're trying to score high as it goes along the rims around the boards and creates a rush the other way, your risk if you keep it along the ice is the goalie can, like, it requires more than just the shot. If you're shooting anything from that far away on any goaltender in the National Hockey League without other factors, you're what, and I've sat and watched games with NHL goalie coaches that would describe it exactly as this, as they watch along. Oh, that's a turnover. And that's, you know, you're ultimately giving up possession. I think this is largely why we're seeing save percentage drop, is because more and more teams recognize what a waste that shot is, and that you're essentially just turning the puck over to the other team, like I said, or at best creating a face-off and, depending on who you have on the ice, a 50-50 chance of winning it back versus having it, controlling it, and looking for a better opportunity. So getting it back to the point, if you have the right people back there and the right traffic, can create a scoring chance. You mentioned layered screens that goes in more often than a breakaway, right? Like, so again, I'm not against the funnel off the initial draw from outside the dots, but it's got to be more than just a straight look at the goaltender. Because the reality is, unless you have an elite shooter in that spot and a crappy goalie, and let me tell you, we've seen a lot of crappy goaltending in the playoffs so far, it's not going in. And all you're doing is giving the other team the puck or a 50th chance to win it back.
We're talking to Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. He's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai, and he's calling in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. And you made the point there, Woodley, about, you know, one of the reasons save percentage is going down is teams are being more selective, right? Fewer teams are content just to throw pucks from anywhere and hope one goes in, and teams are waiting for those really high-quality shot attempts and scoring chances. How much further do you think we have to go down that road? I'm thinking in the NBA, right, where 10 years ago teams started shooting all these three-pointers and people thought, oh my goodness, this is crazy. And now it's like gone to exponentially higher even, where the Boston Celtics are like breaking the game almost. How much more extreme do you think we're going to see NHL teams get on the tendency to prefer shot quality over shot quantity?
It's a really good question, and I don't know, but at the end of the day, I think as this becomes further and further ingrained and deeper ingrained, and when I talk to goaltenders about this for the story that sort of ran halfway through this season, kind of explaining why the sub 900 wasn't the same as we used to regard it, is they talked a lot about young players coming up and into the league, understanding, as I said, that's a turnover. Like, that's not going in, I'm getting yelled at. It used to be if you didn't get it on net, you got yelled at when you went back to the bench. And more of these young players are coming in understanding you're getting yelled at going back to the bench if you waste a shot. And so I think we're going to continue down that path for the most part. There's still going to be some teams, some coaches, some systems that prefer volume, and they'll try and do other things to turn that volume into quality. But I look at Dallas-Winnipeg last night. Like, they both had 24 chances on net. Dallas had 11 high danger and 8 low danger. Winnipeg only had 5 high danger and 16 low danger.
Wow.
They were roughly equal in the mids. Like, you know, I know which one I want as a goalie. And so it's not just about possession, although, like I said, that case can be made too. It's, man, there's nothing tougher than a night where you're not dizzy, but every chance feels like a quality chance. And in the case of what Dallas did to Winnipeg last night, you know, out of 24 chances, 11 were high danger, 16 overall were higher mid. And at the other end, like less than five high danger and 8 high mid combined, like a third of the chances were quality for the Winnipeg Jets. Like, you know, this is sort of the part of the reason. And I'll digress a second. Like, you can make the argument to me, like, we can have the conversation about next year's Olympics as premature as it seems, and how what's happening to Connor Hellebuyck in the playoffs, you know, might be, you know, exhibit A of why maybe he shouldn't be the starter for USA next year. I'd point to the Four Nations and say, I'm not so sure. But if the next step to that argument, because they happen to be head to head right now, is it's Jake Oettinger's net and should be, like, this is part of the discussion around him. Is a lot of what you're seeing in terms of the raw numbers is built around nights like that where the quality just isn't there. And if you grade him out relative, he's been a league average goaltender for the last like 2.5 seasons relative to the quality. Nobody can see it though, because nobody's measuring that quality properly.
Stuart Skinner back in the crease for the Edmonton Oilers tonight. What needs to change about how he's performing in these playoffs when he's gotten the chance so far?
Well, early on it was he couldn't stop high danger. And obviously, you know, that's what Calvin Pickard was giving them. You know, those first two games against LA, there were 19 high danger chances. And Skinner let in 9 goals. The next 3 games combined, there were 19 high-danger chances, and Pickard let in 3. He's got some of the best high-danger numbers in the playoffs right now, Calvin Pickard. And so it allows them to overcome some of the mid and lows that he gives up. When Skinner got back in there last night, two nights ago, the problem was the low danger. Like, that first goal kills you because you control the rebound, you keep it in front of you, and then you basically fall on your ass, which is so uncharacteristic for him because he's not a butt goalie. He's a stomach goalie. He's Luongo. He normally falls forward. He ends up on his butt. They shovel a rebound through him. Like, that's just, you saw McDavid going back to the bench. You saw the look on his face. You saw the sigh. Like, it just undoes your team's ability to have confidence in you. And so I thought he made some good saves as the game went on. They just need better. And the interesting thing is, with all the focus on the goalies in Edmonton, and Skinner in particular.
Yeah, it's Aiden Hill.
Aiden Hill has not been very good at the other end.
Brutal.
Like they win game 2 because he gives up 2 brutal goals from the middle of the ice. And we've been saying this for a while. Like, if you get to the middle of the ice, even high in the zone, and challenge his hands, pucks will go in. And so, you know, that's the one thing that Vegas didn't give up the year they won the cup. They kept teams out of those spots. They'll give you back doors down low where he can use that length and that reach and that deep positioning all day long. But high in the zone, get to the middle of the ice, like, that's what they didn't give up when they won a cup. Edmonton scored some goals that, again, you know, most goaltenders don't go in. That's a low danger chances. So it's, you know, it's tough. It's tough to be a goalie analyst right now. You know, there's only 2 guys left in the playoffs above expected. And we're going to see them tonight in Freddie Anderson and Logan Thompson. Those are the only 2 guys. Ottinger's dead even, right around expected after a couple of games. And he had to dig out of a hole early to get there. So he's right at even. But above expected, it's those 2 left, and that's it. And there's only 6 total amongst the starters. You know, even the guy out of the guys that got knocked out. So it's been a tough go for the goaltenders. I think a part of that is the amount of broken play goals that are going in, the amount of crap that's just being funneled to the net, and the relentlessness with which other teams are going there, and I would argue unimpeded, because nobody seems to want to. This is probably a conversation for another day, but it's about time we had the discussion about protecting goaltenders and guys falling on them in the crease and running into them. And this is what I said when they went to the video review: we're going to lose the goalie interference call, and for the most part we did. Every once in a while we get one as a reaction to a guy getting conkied. But for the most part, it's just been open season on these guys cutting through the crease. And you add that with the amount of bodies and the intensity, and pucks are going in, goalies are going down. It's been a tough go for the goalie union in the playoffs so far.
Let's talk about a goalie who's crushing it in the playoffs, Woody. Arturs Shelovs is up to 930, leading this Abbotsford Canucks team to the conference final at this point for the first time in franchise history. Pretty nice story for him, given how his season went, clearly losing the trust of the organization at the NHL level. But this has been a pretty impressive bounce back. How important for him do you think it was to have had this kind of run of success, especially after the way his year went?
Important for it to continue too, Thomas.
Right.
Like, at the end of the day, I don't know that it changes the math. Like, do you see the Canucks, if they were to decide to move on from a Thatcher Demko, being like, okay, we're good with the way this past season went, we're good with Arturs?
No.
and Laikkanen? No, like, so I don't change it. I think it changes the math there. Maybe it does for another team that thinks about a claim off waivers. But honestly, I'm not sure I see that happening. Yeah, you know, anything sort of a Calder Cup championship and, like, this really being on display for other ones. Like, I think I have a fairly good grasp on how he's regarded around the league. And with a one-way contract, I don't know that he's a guy right now that other teams are going to look at and be like, yeah, because remember, when you claim a guy, it's not just, hey, we want him in our system. It's, hey, we think he can be in the NHL, yeah. Because if you claim him, we got to keep him. So,
Or you end up on the Eric Comrie plan.
Right. But all he can do is in this moment, and this is, I mean, it's what all goalies talk about, one-shot mentality. It's like golf. It's the easiest thing to say and the hardest thing to do, next-shot mentality. And so for everything that happened on the negative side this year to him and for him, all he can do right now is sort of go in each game and show his best and have his best game, regardless of what it means moving forward. So I'm not getting too caught up in what it means for next year or anything like that. But for a guy who's been through the ringer a little bit, nice to see him have this success. Maybe replant a little confidence within the organization, but if nothing else, for himself to, you know, show. And this is a guy who got them to round, like, made this group $40 million last year, mm-hmm. got them to the second round of the playoffs, right? And four home dates in the second round of the playoffs. Like, he did that and got to game seven of the second round of the playoffs. Something was exposed along the way. And I still, even late in the season during the call-ups, there were moments where it looked like the tracking had improved. And I don't mean the tracking like watch the puck. I mean how you watch the puck and does your body move into it or does your body pull away from it that will allow him to have success eventually at the NHL level as he figures out managing traffic, which he's not the first goalie to struggle with. And so we saw signs of it, but I'm not sure it was sticky enough to say definitively he's figured it out or he's on the path to figuring it out. And the reality is at the American Hockey League level, even come playoff time, from what I've seen, and that is somewhat limited, but from what I've seen, it's just you're not seeing that degree of well-executed traffic and point shot plans like you do at the National Hockey League level. There's just not the same level of, I wouldn't say it's the intensity, but it's the execution. So regardless, there's still going to be things that have to be figured out, but good for him in the short term, right?
Yeah.
And if he continues to build confidence, then maybe he comes in to the start of the play, to the preseason next year and can get on a roll that whether it's here or somewhere else proves that someone's willing, you know, proves that he deserves it and somebody's willing to take a shot to let him run with it in the NHL. There are worse things in the world than being first option up. And even rebuilding the confidence that they can feel good about him in that role would be a step right now.
Woodley, really appreciate it as always. Always a pleasure to chat, and we'll do it again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and InGoal Magazine on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George and White Rock or WhiteRockHyundai.com. And guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at PowerWest.ca today. They keep the lights on. I also wanted to say that this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. And just before we go to break here on the subject of the Abbotsford Canucks and what they're doing, and we were talking about the Canucks coaching vacancy earlier, of course, Manny Malhotra is going to be on the short list of candidates, as reported by Elliot Friedman, for that job. John in the Fort said, the Canucks for sure are going to wait to see how deep Malhotra takes the Abbey Canucks in the AHL playoffs before making a coaching move. Right? How would a potential Calder Cup win affect Malhotra's chances at the job? I feel my read of the situation and how positive they've been about Manny Malhotra and now hearing him on the shortlist, I don't know that he has to prove much more in the Calder Cup playoffs to have a legitimate shot at this job. I think the fact that they've already won two series, one of them's a best of three, but now you've won a best of five, you're into the third round. I think he's kind of past the whatever test the Calder Cup playoffs presented for him as a first-year professional head coach at the AHL level. Now, you can always look better if you go on and win, but I almost wonder, you know, if Malhotra leads the Abbey Canucks to a Calder Cup championship, I don't know if that's so much about moving the needle for how the Canucks are interested in Malhotra as much as it would be maybe opening up other options for Malhotra. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's what the effect would be. My view on it is that the Canucks really like Malhotra, and probably even if they get swept by the Colorado Eagles, I don't think that's taking him out of the running for the Canucks head job.
Yeah, I mean, would certainly help his negotiating leverage.
That's what I mean, right? Yeah. It would probably give him more options more than it would convince the Canucks to hire him. Like, I don't know how much convincing they need once you're on the short list, right? And I think then it's going to be more about the interviews and stuff rather than, well, how much farther can he take them in the Calder Cup playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, I look, you win two rounds in your first kick at the can and have an impressive season despite a variety of injuries and absences up top at the NHL level. I mean, that's a phenomenal first season. You make it to the Calder Cup final as a first-time American League head coach.
Yep.
You win the Calder Cup as a first-time American League head coach. Like, you're one for one. I mean, I certainly think it changes local perception around Malhotra. And by the way, like, don't ignore this, okay? One of a head coach's most important responsibilities at the end of the day is to be invested with the trust of the ticket buying public, right? PR is a massive part of the job for a head coach. You are literally talking every day, especially in this marketplace.
I was going to say, especially here, right?
You are a primary spokesperson, and a lot of your commentary can keep the flies off the group, calm things down, right?
Or vice versa.
When you have that trust from the fans, man, everything functions a lot more smoothly in a market where you have to be attuned to the impact of that level of media attention. Did you hear Tanev talking about it the other day? It was an interview with Elliot Friedman.
Yeah.
And he was like, fans just come up to you, whether it's good or bad. You know, like, this market can be a lot. And a coach plays a big role in moderating that and speaking for the organization. So you come off a championship run as Malhotra. I do think it invests you with a little bit more of that, like, glow, that like gravity immediately. He'd have weight in this market anyway,
yes,
because of what he did as a player, because he's lived here for so long, right? Because he stayed after he played, on and on. But you come in as, like, the Calder Cup champion head coach, the one-for-one American League champion. I think that creates, like, a wunderkind vibe around him that would be extraordinarily useful to him if he was in the job. And I bring this up, I know we got to go to break and I'll let us go after this, but I bring this up because that would be one of my big concerns if this team hired Marco Sturm.
Yeah, but let's talk about it on the other side, because I think that is a really interesting point as it relates to what Malhotra does down the stretch here, or I shouldn't say down the stretch, in the Calder Cup playoffs with the Abbey Canucks. So we can talk about that. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, so send your thoughts in about that. We'll look at the Canucks salary cap situation going into the summer as well. That's next on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in. We got an open hour here to finish the show. And as I said, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we were reading a text about Manny Malhotra and, you know, how much does a deep Calder Cup playoff run change the calculus for the Vancouver Canucks? And we were both saying, well, probably more than anything would give Malhotra more options, more leverage, but it also might change the public perception element of either hiring or maybe even more urgently or more specifically not hiring Manny Malhotra. And I know this was something that our pals Donnie and Dolly were talking about today. And by the way, they'll be on the crossover with us a day early tomorrow on Tuesday. But if Malhotra keeps having this success, and it's not just, hey, he's our farm team's coach in the Fraser Valley, he's Manny Malhotra. He's a former Canuck who had an incredible reputation here as a player who people remember really well and think really highly of him.
And now has scored an A-plus on his very first test as a professional head coach.
And basically, the question is it going to be, like, politically feasible from an optics perspective to pass over Manny Malhotra in favor of another rookie NHL head coaching candidate, right? Marco Sturm or Todd Nelson, et cetera.
That's the key.
Because it's one thing if it's experienced guy.
Is it one thing if it's Jay Woodcroft?
Yeah, Jay Woodcroft. That's the thing. It's like, I don't think there is, there's no home run candidate to me.
No.
Like Peter Laviolette's not. Gallant isn't.
Tockett's. No, Tocchet's the last guy standing.
Yeah. And for obvious reasons, that's not a candidate here. So yeah, there yeah. is no, like, is, well, I'd be fine with Mahotra if we can't get this guy.
Is Gerard Gallant's name, like, even out there?
It's starting to get out there, but I don't know if it's going to happen.
Where?
From Elliot Friedman.
Ah, in Vancouver?
No. Just, like, the way he phrased it today was, like, him, Gallant, and Peter Laviolette are both, like, very keen to show everyone that the it wasn't their fault that their last jobs went poorly, basically. We really want to coach. We want to get back in the game was the gist of it. So there you go. But I haven't heard him in like connection with any specific jobs.
Yeah, I mean, Gallant has been like his last three jobs all were he ended up losing
They've
them
been
all.
Very short, very but, short
but,
tenures.
But he ended up losing them all because he was difficult to collaborate with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, contemporary NHL teams don't function that way. You know what I mean? Like, you have to be on the same page with your coach. Your coach has to take notes. You have to, you know, have a plan in terms of what types of players we're targeting and how are we going to use them and what matters to us and are we going to develop young players at the NHL level, which you have to do. I mean, look at the Kako, Hedl, Lafreniere sort of paths through the NHL under first Gallant and then Laviolette.
Mm-hmm.
And Laviolette at least got a bunch out of Lafreniere that first season. He regressed this past year. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think the Rangers looked far more structured under Laviolette than they had under Gallant, and they still look deeply unstructured.
Yikes.
You know what I'm saying? It's like there's levels to this.
Yeah. So what are the openings we have now left, right? Because obviously, the Rangers hired Sullivan, and the Ducks hired Quenneville.
Yep.
And so we've still got Vancouver, Seattle, Pittsburgh, Boston.
Vancouver, Seattle, Pittsburgh, Boston.
Chicago.
Boston still has Joe Sacco as an interim.
Sure, and Chicago still has the interim, too.
And Philadelphia still has Brad Shaw as an interim,
but
and Chicago has Sorensen.
I think we understand they're all involved. They're all in it.
So realistically, we're looking at six vacancies.
Yeah.
Six vacancies.
And it just doesn't feel like there's no... There's no, like, Mike, now that Sullivan's off the market, and then it's Tocchet, there's no, like, heavy hitter waiting in the wings to take these jobs.
Tocchet's it.
It's Tocchet, yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be, you know, Woodcroft.
Well, and that's why, like, we're in mid-May, early mid-May. And there's certainly some Canucks fans who are like, I thought Tocchet was going to get a job right away. And it's like, it's mid-May.
Yeah.
The coaching cycle lasts for another month beyond this.
Also, and again, this was what Elliot Friedman was reporting here, but like it's very...
Tocchet's going to smell like the vault.
Based on what is being reported, it is Tocchet taking his time making a decision rather than teams being anyway skeptical of Tocchet.
Yeah, and it's like, do we have any evidence that Tocchet likes to take his time and be thoughtful about decision making? Do we have any evidence of that?
We sure do.
Didn't it take, like, I mean, could you argue that it took him an extra month to take the job in Vancouver, given how that all played
out? That's a fascinating, like, retrospective point of view on that situation and why on earth it was taking so long.
Right, because we were all like, what
is happening?
What is going on?
Remember the, like, well, he needs to give his 2 weeks' notice. It's like, guys, no, he doesn't. I assure you, okay. he's not like working out the notice period with Turner.
On the long list of absurd things we've spent time talking about on this show, Tocchet's working through his 2 week notice has got to be one of the highlights.
Like, I assure you, that's not how those contracts work.
They'd never land a coach.
I just love it. It just always brings me up, like, me quitting my job at Red Robin. And they're like, oh, man, but we really need you for these shifts. I was like, okay, well, I can do a week. You know what I mean? It's like, that's not how it works. That's not how it works with Rick Tocchet and TNT. Like, hey, man, we have you on the schedule for Friday. There's no one else who can cover. We need you to come in that day. It's like, no, I'm going to take this NHL head coaching job.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, also, when you're, like, entry level, most of the time people are just like, that's fine. At least in my experience.
Like, bye.
Bye.
Nice knowing you.
Or no, I'm like, here, I'm giving my 2 weeks. They're like, we never want to see you again.
Okay. Can you leave now?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Absolutely. This one, Mason and Campbell River, just to bring it back to the Malhotra side of things. He says, if the Canucks don't jump on Manny, then we might see another NHL club give him the job. And that's really what we're talking about here, especially to me, if it ends up going to the Calder Cup finals or even a Calder Cup win, right? All of a sudden, then I think you have not just a coaching prospect who's very, very interesting for the Vancouver Canucks, but somebody who's on a lot of radars league-wide as a really young, exciting coaching prospect. And whether that's to immediately take on the head coaching job for a franchise or to do like the Mitch Love route where he was a really well thought of AHL head coach, didn't get the job in Calgary, ends up on Washington's bench. Now he's really well positioned to get a job in this cycle, right? That could be Malhotra's next step as well. So I think that's where it starts to become a delicate situation from the Canucks' perspective, because if we play out this hypothetical, and the Abbey Canucks run continues and Malhotra really boosts his profile around the league, and then the Canucks hire, for example, Marco Sturm, there's going to be a lot of, oh my goodness, we're going to let Malhotra's going to walk. We're going to lose this incredible coaching prospect we had in our organization, and he's a former Canuck. And that's going to be the reaction. That's can be difficult. As you said, public relations is part of the job. You want to have somebody that the fan base has confidence in and has earned the trust of the fan base. But I also think back to the Tocchet transition from Boudreaux. That was a phenomenally unpopular decision at the time. Like, people were, and I got it because the way it was carried out was insane.
He was booed when he was introduced to Canucks fans and made a joke about it.
So the reaction there was
joke again.
I don't know.
Did he suggest we were saying Boo Earns?
I don't think he did. That would have been. I would remember that if he had said that.
He had a good joke though.
Probably. I'm a funny guy. But anyways, my point is...
No, but right from the start, even from his first press conference when he's like talking about eating an elephant and stuff, we were just like, this is hilarious. Let's go.
Yes, absolutely.
No?
I was. But the eating the elephant thing, people were like not thrilled with that.
Really?
Yeah, there was a weird reaction to that one.
Was there?
Yes, there was.
Because he failed to accurately paraphrase Bishop Desmond Tutu?
People were very up in arms about it. But my point is,
from an animal rights perspective,
no, I have no idea. My point is, at the time, it was controversial, unpopular. Oh my gosh, why are you firing Boudreaux? Rick Tocchet, look at his record in Tampa and Arizona. This is ridiculous. It all flipped when he started winning. One, when they started winning and they immediately looked like a different team with him, even in that first season. And then obviously the next season after that, they had an incredibly successful year. So they started winning and he won over fans with the way he communicated, the way he talked. So I think it's notable, the fear of, okay, how will it look if we don't hire Malhotra and we hire somebody else and maybe Malhotra leaves the organization? Like, is that putting Marco Sturm or whoever it is, Todd Nelson, in a tough spot if we go with them over Malhotra? I think that's fair and I understand that, but I also don't think you can let those considerations override the most important thing, which is just, you know what fans are going to appreciate about a coach who wins. And yeah, there's other things as well. They want someone who can communicate and all of that. But first and foremost, you have to go with the coach you think gives you the best chance to win, because that's going to make everything else a secondary consideration as far as fans are concerned.
Yeah, you got to get your guy. Like, you got to get your guy. And one thing about, you know, Rutherford, I think, is he's mostly had a pretty successful track record hiring coaches.
Yeah.
I think the Mike Johnston example would kind of be the exception to that rule, but he got a late start, right? Again, that's the instructive one. Actually, there's another thing I want to talk about. I'll save it for the next segment, but that's the instructive one, is that when he got the job in Pittsburgh, the coaching cycle was like already, you know, well established. There was basically two top candidates left on the market. There was the top WHL coach, mm-hmm. which was Mike Johnston, and there was the top AHL coach, the Calder Cup winner that season, which was our guy, Willie D. Real good candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And Rutherford felt pressed. He didn't feel like he had time to get his guy. He felt like he had to sort of settle for Mike Johnston. And Mike Johnston, as a rookie coach, wasn't well cut out to fit in, frankly, with Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, Chris Letang led group. I mean, mm-hmm. that there was a lot of weight in that locker room. You know, I think the way that to this day, I think Rutherford would tell you, it wasn't that Mike Johnston was not the right coach generally. He was the wrong coach for that team.
Yeah.
Anyway, he ended up hiring Mike Sullivan as an assistant, which worked out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think they lost on the Willie D face-off to Trevor Linden. I think that was always baked in. I think that was basically a leverage play from Willie D. to make sure he got what he wanted from fellow Medicine Hat Tigers alum Trevor Linden, and the rest is history.
By the way, did you see that the Medicine Hat Tigers
lost?
No, well, that and Gavin McKenna's point streak came to an end. But they also drafted Brock Lesnar's son.
I did see that.
Which the only reason I bring it up is that there's at least a chance now that Brock Lesnar and Willie Desjardins will meet face to face.
Wow.
And just what a phenomenal meeting that would be.
That's real good.
Just wanted to get that out there.
Willie D, man.
Willie D and Brock Lesnar. Talking about Duke's development path.
Honestly, there's something really funny about that entire era. Like the fact that it was Jim Rutherford losing a negotiating face-off.
Against Jim Benning and...
Well, no, against Trevor Linden. Yeah. Really, it was Trevor at the time. But losing a face-off to Trevor Linden, and the bell of the ball being Willie Desjardins. When you like think about it today, it's just so funny. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is just so funny. And then,
well, that's a great lesson for coach hiring cycles 100%. Generally, right? Where it's like the hype correlation with results does not always line up, or maybe frequently does not line up with who actually ends up getting the results.
Or how about this? The Canucks that summer before hiring Willie D fired who?
Mike Sullivan. Yeah, as an assistant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rutherford hired him to manage the American League team, and that obviously ended up being one of the most successful decade-long runs. I mean, the Canucks, how many coaches have the Canucks have had? Four coaches before Sullivan finally left Pittsburgh as a two-time Stanley Cup champion. And I'd add this, the Canucks also blew up the compensation, the short-lived compensation regime, because they demanded a second round pick, or at least inquired as to their rights for a second round pick, when the Pittsburgh Penguins internally promoted Mike Sullivan.
Yep.
And the league was like, this is insane. This is not what we want to do. You are not getting a second round pick for your American or for your assistant coach who's being promoted from the American League. Anyway, good fun times.
Absolutely. We have a couple questions coming in about Adam Foote. One simply saying, is Foote still in the running? And we know from Elliot Friedman, Sturm and Malhotra, two of the names on the shortlist. He expects only one or two additional names on the shortlist. I don't know if Adam Foote is among those. I don't know who else might round out that list. Would Foote, do you think, have some of the same issues of a external candidate coming in over Malhotra? It's different with Foote because he's been here, obviously, and I think he does have a fairly decent cachet with the fan base, given how well the blue line has performed in his tenure. But again, it would seem odd to me, and I've made this point before, that if you have, like, just based on resume, Malhotra looks like the stronger head coaching candidate to me because he's done the job. He's been a head coach now. Well, just for 1 year.
I know.
To be fair, Foote's done in the WHL.
No, but I think the point is that
it's successful.
Foote's WHL season didn't go well.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not like, with Malhotra, you can look at the lack of experience and be like, well, if you get to the Final Four in your first try, sure, you don't have experience, but what we've seen is real nice. What we've seen is real good. Whereas, real good. Oh my God, I've got
Willie. Now you're doing it.
I've got Willie D disease. Whereas with Foote, it's like, he's inexperienced and we're projecting him to do a far better job at the NHL level than he did as a WHL coach. And the reason that we're believing that he's improved that much is based on 1 year's worth of work, right? Like, you know what I mean? Or sorry, a successful two and a half year stint as an assistant coach. Like, that just feels like a much bigger bet.
Yeah, for sure. Rocket and Langley says, what I would really like to see is Manny at head coach and Foote stay in his position. I think he's just really good with it. And Foote could also advise Manny on the goings on in the dressing room. I don't know if that's on the table, like Foote on Manny Malhotra's staff.
I mean, look, money talks.
Sure.
And, you know, Manny's been a relatively well integrated part of Tocchet's staff. So there's at least a relationship there between Malhotra and Foote. I don't know if they cross paths as like teammates at any point during their playing careers. I'd be surprised, but also I think Adam Foote had like a
Columbus
couple...
maybe.
When was Columbus?
Let me see.
So was that
when was
the Foote
in Columbus? Because Malhotra spent a bunch of years.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. I mean, if it's like 06 to 10, then
yeah, I think so. Hold on.
Or 06 to 08.
You keep talking.
You can't cross-reference elite prospects?
I'm looking right now. Yeah, they totally would have been. Okay. 07-08 Columbus Blue Jackets. Manny Malhotra and Adam Foote.
There you go. Okay, so they have been teammates.
Yeah.
That matters. Okay, so if there's familiarity and trust there and you make Foote an associate head coach, maybe. But I would expect wherever Rick Tocchet lands, You know, we would think that he's getting the glam and glitz package, and the glam and glitz package usually includes a massive deal for
your preferred lieutenant.
Just like, remember when the Canucks lost Brad Shaw to Torts in Philadelphia, right? Like, you know, they came and offered him years that the Canucks were not going to offer an assistant coach, and that played.
Yeah.
So I would think we're looking at something similar.
The conversation, if it does end up being Manny Malhotra, but really, if it ends up being most of the names we've heard, including Marco Sturm, who would be a first-time NHL head coach, the question of the staff and what the rest of the staff looks like is going to be very interesting, right? Whether it's somebody in the Mike Yeo position who's been an NHL head coach but is now an assistant, or just an extremely experienced NHL assistant. That question of how do they round out the staff is going to be a really important one. That was already a talking point and a question, right? This year, and then I think exiting this year before we knew Tockett was out, because, I mean, Tockett himself brought it up, right? Hey, some of the part-time stuff, maybe that's not working out with Sergei Gonchar. You had Foote. You also had Yogi Shevkosky, and there was questions about how effective the power play was last year and whether they needed to adjust how they handled that. So I think you were already looking at maybe some fairly significant changes beyond, like, if Tockett had stayed, you'd have Tockett and Foote for sure. And then I think it was a bit of an open question what the rest of the coaching staff would look like. Then you throw in the new head coach and the possibility that it's a relatively inexperienced candidate like Manny Malhotra. And I think there's going to be, like, I've often joked that we pay more attention than any other market to assistant coaches in Vancouver. And not pay more attention,
sorry, we don't,
but assign more credit,
right,
blame.
We go a little far. We go a little far.
Yeah, of course we do. But having said that, and it's something that I've often like poked fun at, I think nailing the assistant, the staff, is also going to be really important if it's Manny Malhotra, if it's Marco Sturm.
I think as a market, though, we are bad at evaluating coaches.
I think as a sport, we're bad at evaluating coaches. Like, as a global sport fan base. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think, is there a market in the NHL that you think nails coaching evaluations? I don't think so.
Probably not.
I think it's so whiplash. I mean, just look at the Jack Adams Award.
Yeah, it's just results based.
It's so whiplash results based, right?
Okay.
So I don't think it's anything unique to Vancouver. I think it's just probably of the big four sports, we struggle most to evaluate hockey coaches, I would say.
Fair enough. Just like as a exercise really quickly before we go to break, okay? List of head coaches in Vancouver Canucks history.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to give me a top five ranking, and I'm just going to tell you why you're wrong.
AV.
Number one?
I'm just going like through.
Okay. Well, okay. You want
so
me
number
to
one,
do the whole list?
Number one,
you
Pat
can do
Quinn.
Top five off the top of your head.
Okay. AV.
Over AV?
You just gave me crap for giving AV. AV, Pat Quinn,
one,
Crawford.
Two. These are in order.
No. This is off the top of my head.
Okay.
So AV, Pat Quinn, Crawford.
Yep. Harry Neal. Bob McCammon. Rick Lay. Tom Rennie.
Before my time.
Mike Keenan.
No.
Tortorella.
No. Talker Travis Green.
Oh, they're definitely top five. I don't know what else to tell people. They're both definitely top five.
Yeah, but I would say the number one and two is AV and Pat Quinn, right? Like 100%.
Yeah. I mean.
And then I think you probably have to put Crawford there, even though they never.
No.
No, you don't think so?
Nope. I have zero issues leaving Mark Crawford. Zero issues telling you straight up this team was better coached by both Travis Green and Rick Tockett than it was by Mark Crawford.
Fair enough.
Just is what it is. I'm sorry. Phil Maloney rounds out my top five.
Of course. How could we forget the Phil Maloney era?
You don't remember the Phil Maloney era?
I do not. No.
Dude, Phil Maloney is like Mr. Canuck from 1960 to 1980. Like,
so Phil Maloney on HockeyDB, one season as Canucks head coach, the 1973-1974 season.
First year they made the playoffs. And that's not right, because he had a second
stint. No, it says they're out of the playoffs.
Yeah, he was 1972 to 73. Or sorry, he was head coach through 77.
Okay, HockeyDB is wrong then.
Yeah, they made the playoffs twice in his tenure.
All right.
He brought like a professionalism that they'd completely lacked before him.
Oh, by the way, people are mad that we haven't brought up Roger Nilsson, which is fair.
Oh,
very fair. Wow, that's a big 100%. Miss.
We completely whiffed. Roger Nilsson is in the top three.
Yeah. So it's AV, Pat Quinn, and Roger Nilsson.
Unquestioned top three.
Yeah.
And then two of, in my opinion anyway, Tockett, Maloney, Travis Green.
All right.
That's my top five.
Top six.
Well, I made a top six. I'm going to give Travis Green an honorable mention and bump him off the list. Sorry.
And put Tockett in there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. I can live with that. Okay. We'll take a break. I did want to get into the salary cap stuff.
Wow. I feel like such a fraud for missing Roger Neilson. That's terrible.
We're doing it off the top of our head. It's fine. True. Who cares? It's live radio. It's fine. Anyways, we'll take a break. One more segment coming up. I want to get into the Canucks salary cap outlook for the summer in the final segment here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintech Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. So much attention on the Canucks coaching vacancy. But of course, we're also doing our normal look ahead to how the roster stands, and maybe more importantly, also how the salary cap picture stands going into the summer. And as I said, this is a staple exercise, certainly for you at The Athletic, for us on this show, trying to figure out, okay, let's really drill down and figure out how much money do the Canucks have to play with here to fill how many spots going into the summer. And of course, a big part of that exercise this year is we're finally dealing with an area of cap growth, an area of accelerated cap growth after, yeah, a little bit of an increase going into last season, but of course before that, flat for a number of years.
Yes, the largest proportional increase since the summer of 2008 and the largest total value increase ever.
Yeah.
Like in the cap era, $7.5 million, going to be $8.5 million after this season and then another $7.5 million. Yeah, you're basically baking in $23.5 million in cap growth. And while usually I'm pretty pessimistic in trusting cap growth based on a long history of observing how the NHL actually functions, the truth is that especially with the broadcast rights deal that the league already agreed to with Rogers, announced after we got these figures, I think we can actually proceed with due optimism that this plan will in fact play out relatively smoothly. Fingers crossed that all these recession indicator jokes are just that. Jokes and memes. Anyway, the cap growth aspect is really interesting because, you know, to summarize it, I drill down and sort of go through Canucks re-signing guys like Derek Forbert, some of the RFAs, on, and sort of end up with like 11.5-12 million that the club can use to sign two extra guys. One of the main theories posited.
And like two forwards is really what we're talking about.
Two top six forwards.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, two top six forwards plus a guy maybe, right? Like, so that's a fair bit of cap flexibility. The problem is that this rising tide will float all boats, right? It's not just the Canucks. And when you really look around and drill down, I mean, one thing about this offseason or sort of this new league year upcoming that will hold the Canucks back is that balloon year of Oliver Ekman-Larsson's buyout, where you know, the Canucks have got an astounding amount of cap benefit from buying out Ekman-Larsson's deal. Now, the last two seasons, like, they got $7 million in cap benefit the first year, they got about $5 million in cap benefit the second year. That's $12 million in cap benefit across the last two seasons as a result of that deal. However, the next 2 years, the cap benefit's only $3 million. So we're talking about a $4.666667 million buyout cost. A buyout penalty, effectively, that the Canucks will be eating this year and next. And that eats up a fair, like, that additional $2.5 million going toward that eats up a fair bit of the growth that the Canucks will benefit from. Additionally, they've got the $712,500 cap hit that they retained in the Ilya Mikheyev transaction. So between those two guys, you've got the Canucks with $5.5 million in dead space. That's the third most in the NHL. Okay, only two teams have more dead space on their books for this season. And what that effectively equates to is that while the Canucks have meaningful cap flexibility to address their issues, they have relatively less buying power than most teams. They have a below average amount of buying power relative to the rest of the NHL's member clubs. Really, to the point where, do you know what the average number of cap, like median cap space going into the summer is over $20
million. Wow. Yeah.
I mean,
that's just a completely different world than we're used to living in.
And that's why, like I said, I jokingly said that Sam Bennett's going to get 10 times 8 on Helford and Bruff today, and I saw some people losing their minds on Twitter about that number, and it's like, I might be going low.
If he hits the market.
If he hits,
we'll see.
And then I guess he can't get 8.
Yeah, so that's true. I mean, you never know, right steals or whatever, but
I'm just saying, like, we're going to see some valuations that have almost no relationship to anything that's come before it, and that's as it should be. Like, well, that's good for the game.
And I think the combination of what you're talking about, right, where it's like, yes, they have, what, $11 million plus for a couple of players, that sounds really good, but it's also, you know, it'd be one thing if you thought, hey, we need one top six forward, okay? And then you're in the zone where it's like, okay, we're going to aggressively overspend to try to get Nick Ehlers here, right? We're gonna go to him with the, you know, $9.5 or $10 million offer, and yeah, that's all of our ammunition.
12,
but
don't even blink.
Okay, but it's like then you can't get the other guy. You've got one guy, but you still are missing the other guy.
I'll figure it out.
But anyways, my point is
to figure it out.
My point is it lends more credence to something we've talked about, which is that the trade route is much more feasible than the free agent route. And that's obviously partly because it's just the limited options in free agency and the difficulty getting them here. But also because, yeah, you're like, to win the bidding for Nick Ehlers, you're spending almost all your cap space. Yep. And so if you want to be able to do multiple guys, and I mean, forget even going down the road to three, that I think pretty clearly is going to require some subtractions from the roster if you want three new guys in the top six going into next season. But even for two, you're not doing two top six players for free agency. Like, you'd be hard pressed to do Besser and Pugh Suter.
Well, that's the other critical point here is by the time you get to 11.5, because you've signed or retained Derek Forbert,
yep,
and you've signed Atu Ratu, and you've, you know, on and on, like, you're already at a point where what most of those models, whether it's that ASP or the evolving hockey model that I prefer, especially for RFAs, because they've regularly hit a 0.9 R squared in terms of projecting those outcomes, what those models are projecting, the Canucks won't have space for both. Like, we're already at a point where just bringing the band back together requires the club most likely subtracting a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other sort of point that I can't escape here, is the more I look at the numbers and the math here, the more convinced I am that the club has to at least consider dealing Teddy Bluger for cap reasons and to open up an everyday spot for Atu Ratu in the lineup.
Well, and this question came in from Mac in North Van, who said, what's a realistic return for Garland? Love him, but we could use the $5 million in cap space. And then he says, same question for Bluger. And you start to go through the list, and obviously Bluger, the cap savings aren't significant, but you're also in this world where every little bit helps, right? And so, as you say, if you're opening up a spot for Atu Ratu, and then you're also saving, what, $900,000 by making that switch from Ratu to Bluger, could that be the difference in landing the guy you want or having the flexibility to acquire the player you want? Probably not, but at least you got to give yourself the chance to go out and do it.
Yeah, and I think the way to think about it too is the Canucks still have space to pull off some incredibly aggressive stuff, especially on the trademark. They're not going to be inhibited or like really struggling against the cap or facing like gut-wrenching decisions.
Sure.
Like, should we buy out Oliver Ekman-Larsson even though the cap hit hits us, you know, right in the solar plexus at the worst possible time during Quinn Hughes' prime, right? Which, I mean, we were talking about that 2 years ago when they did buy out OEL, right? Like, that mm-hmm. was one of my main points, was the timing of this sucks.
Yeah.
Given when you expect this core group to sort of hit. Now, obviously, it's been a complicated couple of years since, but
some other things have happened in there.
Some other stuff has happened, yeah. We're very much like the dog meme with the sort of like Apocalypse Now background going like, anyway, the sort of truth of this, right, is they have space to be aggressive, but they're not positioned to where like the cap will work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They don't have cap space that can be like used as value necessarily.
Well, I think that's going to be so much harder to do now. to be like, hey, we'll take your bad contract. It's like, but well, we have cap space. We don't need you to take our bad contract. You know what I mean?
Except that there still are teams that are pressed up against it. I mean, you're not wrong. I'm not trying to say that you are.
It's going to be
wrong.
I think I was trying to avoid using the word fertile, but I'll do it. A less fertile market.
Fertile.
I was trying to think of a better word. It's like, whatever. I'll
down
just say
boy. okay. But the Dallas Stars have like $6 million in cap space.
Sure.
And an awful lot of key UFAs to get done. The Tampa Bay Lightning have $7 million in cap space. Like we were talking about guys who like would be good fits or whatever. And I was like, Nick Paul? And you're pretty uninterested, I'd say.
When was this? I like Nick Paul.
Oh, this was
this Josh?
Josh, yeah, maybe been Josh. Sorry,
I was gonna say I like Nick Paul.
My bad. Caps $8 million in cap space. Like, you know, the point is not that those teams are gonna be feeling pressure to make moves, but if the Capitals get into free agency and they're like, oh, we have a shot to get Gavrikov, you know, on a relatively team friendly deal, but we have to shed some salary first, you know, does that become something that's interesting?
Yeah.
Right? Or, I mean, they've got to have a couple key RFAs coming up, for example, right? So there's the Colorado Avalanche are another example. But, yeah, I mean, the Alexiev's the only one. Yeah, so anyway, they don't have a lot of pressure on them now, but it's coming. So I still think there's going to be that ability to acquire players affordably from aggressive teams that need to shed because they want to spend their cap space elsewhere. Like, that's still going to exist, and the Canucks can make those deals, but they're not sledding downhill the way like a Columbus is, right? Or or one of those teams like Anaheim that...
Or Chicago or whoever, yeah.
Yeah, like those teams that should be really looking long and hard about going the offer sheet direction and trying to land like a game changer. Like, forget sifting through the unrestricted free agent pool. Now, here's another thing that I've been thinking about I want to bring up.
Okay.
As an idea. I haven't fleshed it out in a piece yet, but all I'm right. sure I will at some point. So, back in... Man, I don't know the year.
All right. We're off to a good start.
Killing
right, this
it.
Is part of the fleshing out process when you write it.
100%.
Back in brackets. Figure out year.
Back in 2005.
All right.
Coming out of the NHL lockout. The Carolina Hurricanes, then managed by Jim Rutherford.
Of course.
Were in hot pursuit of a star winger in free agency. So sorry, I messed up the date. No, I didn't. I don't think I did, actually.
All right.
The date was 05. And they were in hot pursuit of North Vancouver's Paul Kariya.
All right.
And they got to the precipice of a deal and Kariya ended up signing with the Nashville Predators instead. Left the Carolina Hurricanes at the altar. And the Carolina Hurricanes, deeply pissed off about it, pivoted and signed a guy with far less cachet and far less sort of star pedigree in Ray Whitney, the Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ray Whitney was a good player. He'd had some 70-point seasons, some 60-point seasons prior to that, but his longevity across the next 7 years of his career in both Carolina and Phoenix was preposterous, right? He scored 9 goals in 24 games when the Hurricanes won the Cup. We're talking about a consistent, like, 55-point guy at the tail end of the dead puck era, right? You know, a really impressive career. And he was, at that point, like, pretty old. He was, like, 32, 33. Wasn't the sexiest move, but it added a dynamic veteran scoring presence to that Carolina Hurricanes lineup, and in combination with 21-year-old 100-point Eric Staal, which, you know, people don't remember how good Staal was, or like the superstar level.
Eric Staal at that stage was a monster, an absolute monster.
Was a problem.
He was a problem, yes.
And so people forget that. Anyway, Jim Rutherford's Carolina team, in search of scoring help, pursued star winger, got left at the altar on it. The pivot turned out to be just as good, if not better, than the player that they missed out on. And they ended up winning the Cup that year. First year, year one, right away it worked. And they had another deep run 2 years later. So I've been thinking about that from the perspective of this offseason, from a Canucks perspective. And the idea of, Is there a Whitney out there?
Yeah, who's this year's Ray Whitney?
Who's this year's Ray Whitney? And can the Canucks find him? And the guy I keep coming back to is Matt Duchene.
Yeah, that's the name that jumps off the page for sure as among, the potential.
Among unrestricted free agents.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be an unrestricted free agent. Right? Like, there's,
right.
There's got to be a guy on a team somewhere. Well, and sorry, let me give you another one, although it like makes me gag in my mouth.
Is it Granlund?
What about Patrick Kane?
I just don't think...
It's too gross, right?
It's too gross, but
he probably doesn't want to play in Canada.
No, but...
He definitely
just,
has
like,
never thought of himself in a Canucks jersey.
I think there's like a tipping point where you get too old to be the next Ray Whitney. And I think Patrick Kane is there.
I mean, you're not wrong.
And I think you could probably say the same thing about Marchand, speaking of gross additions as well.
You're not wrong. Although I would say the gap between Patrick Kane and Marchand is sharp. And 36, though he is, Patrick Kane, he was the engineer of a Detroit Red Wings power play that was still, like, exceptional.
I get that, but you need the 5-on-5 capabilities.
Yeah.
And I don't think he has it anymore.
Fair enough.
And so that's it. And forget even going down the road of, like, the Blackhawks rivalry and all that and Patrick Kane himself. It's like, I just don't think that's the player they need. That's not the player type they need. Duchene, I think, is still just on the young enough bar where you can talk yourself into it.
Tavares, if he shook loose?
Yeah, I mean, that's a non-starter, but...
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
But I think Matt Duchene's probably going to be a non-starter.
Probably. So you're probably looking at the trade market then.
Yeah. I'm just saying. Just an idea.
Nelson, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to come to Canada.
No.
Just overall, right? A mode of thinking. The wizard, right? Can the Canucks identify their version, the 2025 version of the wizard this year, this summer, I think is like a helpful way of thinking about like, hey, it's not the move that's going to jump off the page and excite everybody on July 1, but come February when the guy's on a 10-game point streak and, you know, the team's got a plus 10 goal differential in his minutes, could you be very, very pleased with what you've actually received in terms of offensive pop and contributions from that guy, whoever he is, somewhere around the NHL right now?
I do think another thing that they could use, and thinking about those...
Jeff Skinner?
But those Carolina Hurricanes teams, right? Because, of course, they also featured Justin Williams. Now, Justin Williams put up points. Like, he was an extremely productive player, but he was also a guy who famously his value outstripped his production, right? Like, you did not get a full picture of his value just from looking at his goals and assists.
Although today people would know.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
because
the Carolina Hurricanes had a bunch of guys like that, like Eric Cole was another who I don't think now we would know.
Yeah.
But back then, we were just like, Eric Cole, whatever, he's a second-line guy. And it's like, no, he's got one of the most unique physical profiles in the league.
But I think, like, the no-stats all-star type of thing, you know what I mean? Now, Justin Williams had stats. But you know what I mean? Like, the guy who, what do you always say, like, can set the table, but not necessarily eat? But, like, that's kind of what the Canucks need more than anything else.
A table setter.
Yeah.
I mean, they need
They do. But like an elite play driver, even if they're not an incredible finisher,
100%.
You know, even if their stats are like, okay, well, they're not really a power play guy, so their stats don't jump off the page, but they're a dog and they drive play.
I would take it.
That would be amazing.
I feel like you're going to be like,
but I don't know who that is.
I feel like you're going to do the Nathan Fielder, like serving me up nothing, because you're going to be like, Anthony Beauvillier is available. And I'm going to be like, no,
absolutely not.
Stop it.
Absolutely not. By the way, Austin and Langley text in, who is most likely to be subtracted from the roster? Does it depend on who the new coach is? Which is an interesting other element here, right? Is that, and I made this point on the morning show, we're so used to running every player through the immediate filter of, is he a Rick Tocchet type of guy, right? And so it's like, no, that guy's too small. He's not a Rick Tocchet type of player. Well, we don't know who the new coach is. So that consideration could change, and I think it's especially relevant with Connor Garland, who had such a close relationship with Rick Tocchet. Does that make him, trading him and using that that cap space more likely?
The problem is I feel like if you were to tell me who's the next wizard, like Garland feels to me like a pretty good answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. By the way, somebody texted in Jamie Benn.
Have you been watching the playoffs?
I mean, they're all old. All everyone we're talking about is old.
Yeah. I think I'm selling on that. I also think he's like, doesn't he feel like for sure, like 4 years times 1.5.
Oh, no, not 1.5. There's no way he's taking 1.5, even to stay in Dallas. Zero chance. I don't think.
You're probably right.
Like 4, 3, something like that, but not 1.5.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think so.
He had 50 points this year.
So basically you're saying, yeah.
He could make a lot.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
He could make a lot. Like, if he wanted to go make money, he could make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So you know what? I'm willing to... Jamie Benn can play some center, right? Like, pretty good on the draw.
Mm-hmm.
35, 6'3", still has a unique profile. Would certainly bring some, like, damn straight to the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm in. You know what? I'm in. I'm not... I'm 100% not out on that.
All right.
Yeah.
I like that, because you're not necessarily in. You could be in a in-between space, something that's neither out nor in. You're definitely not out.
What about Jonathan Marchessault?
Sure.
They probably have some regrets.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of term left. He still had 56 points this season.
I like that.
Marchessault as a wizard?
I like
Marchessault,
absolutely.
Wizard 2.0?
Yeah. Cheap, distressed asset? Because I do like how you were setting up, because we've talked so much about... Like,
I don't think he'd be happy to come to Vancouver, though, given the old tiffs he had with Canucks fans on Instagram during the bubble, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Because we've talked so much about, like, okay, they need to take this big swing on a distressed talent with superstar upside. And it's like, wait a second, that's Elias Pettersson. And it's like, okay, they need to find the, like, guy...
Undervalued.
Like, play-driving
player.
Guy.
He's not
like,
sexy, but he wins.
It's like, wait a second, that's Connor Garland. It's yeah. Like, wait, what? Dang it.
They have all the profiles of bets that you want to make.
It just hasn't worked.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. I'm not going to lie. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the ways that I'm thinking about this is that unsexy move, the wizard of 2025.
Well, that's why I bring up Granlund's name, because like that's the least sexy signing that's going to happen on July 1st or 2nd is Michael Granlund going somewhere.
We're getting
whether it's Vancouver or not.
We're getting some suggestions. Some suggestions. Smaltz from Utah. Man, I would like it a lot more if you were keeping Besser, because they had that college chemistry.
Right.
I do think Utah needs to upgrade on Smaltz. I don't think you want Smaltz in your top six, unfortunately. Duchesne is obviously a popular suggestion. That's damn straight. Yan Gord. I don't know about that.
I don't know if he has the upside.
Jonathan Toews, interesting. I think that makes me sick. Although I would love to see Jonathan Toews. One of the great interviews in hockey. I would love to see him back in the league playing well. Someone's laughing at my hatred for Verhaeghe. Verhaeghe's actually, he's got an...
Do you hate Carter Verhaeghe? No, I didn't know that.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
They were talking about him. Bruff framed it to me as like, would Verhaeghe be the best forward on the Canucks?
Mm.
And I was like, absolutely not. How dare you? What are you talking about? But Verhaeghe would be interesting, given that I feel like the Panthers probably regret the heck out of that contract. Now, he does have an NTC.
Mm.
Or a full NMC.
What's he making now?
Hold on. Too much.
We gotta finish the show here.
No, he's not making too much, but the Panthers have a lot going on.
Oh, yeah, they signed him with that big extension. Yeah, you're right, and now they do have a lot going on. Yeah, interesting. All right, we'll leave it on that note. What a great note to end things on. By the way, he's making $7 million till 2033. Just not to leave the listeners hanging here. We'll finish it on that note. Special Tuesday edition of the show tomorrow with both the crossover, and we're trying to get Jason Bugala. We'll see if we can lock him down for Tuesday as well, but definitely the crossover tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.